It's the Burt Cohen Show. A few nations, really, of different cultures, different religions. We have a separation of church and state. Oftentimes, politics and religion do kind of merge together. And one of the big groups of people that vote in this country are Catholics. There's a lot of Catholics, and there's been a lot of storminess in the Catholic Church of late. And it's beyond belief, really. But could it be a better future for the faithful of the Catholic Church? Well, I'm very pleased to have with us today Ed Wilson. Ed, thanks for being with us.
You're most welcome. Happy to be here.
Well, Ed Wilson is a native of Brooklyn, New York, and has lived most of his life there after 16 years of Catholic education, including Regis High School in New York, and Holy Cross College in Worcester, Mass., both Jesuit institutions. After 2 years in the Navy, he earned his law degree from Columbia University, practiced corporate business and finance law for 40 years. Now retired, he's still an actively practicing Catholic with his wife Anne, attends Mass regularly in Brooklyn, and is a national trustee and member of the communications group of Voice of the Faithful, the International Catholic Church Reform Organization founded in Boston in the wake of those revolutions of clerical sexual abuse of children. Well, again, thanks, Ed Wilson, for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show. A storm has been gathering for quite some time in the Catholic Church, and now it seems that perhaps that storm is breaking. Some have even begun referring to what's happening in the Catholic Church as a Catholic Spring. Let's hope it's more successful than the Arab Spring. What are some examples of this change happening and any kind of indication of a Catholic Spring?
Well, I guess the thing that got Voice of the Faithful started 10 years ago was the sexual abuse crisis. Not that there hadn't been problems before that, and not that there hadn't been a sexual abuse crisis before that, but the Boston Globe did a very comprehensive series on the issue in early 2002. I think it first exploded on January 6, 2002, which we count as something of an anniversary for ourselves. And that brought together 25 pretty well-educated people at St. John the Evangelist Church in Wellesley, Massachusetts. And they met in the basement, having read all these stories about what Cardinal Waugh was and was not doing about the situation, mostly not doing, or actively doing wrong things, like transferring priests around, who had been accused of sexual abuse without warning either the congregation or even the pastor of the guy's history. And these 25 people, one of whom was our current president, Mark Mullaney, got together and decided this nonsense has to stop, and it's time for we lay people, men and women, to get together to do something about it. Originally, I think they thought they would be able to talk to the bishops and to the hierarchy and everybody would be reasonable. That turned out to be a fantasy. And so we've been going ever since. And since that time, a number of things have erupted. Most recently, what I call the Inquisition on the nuns, the Catholic nuns, who are under an interdict practically from the Vatican now, that to report everything they do to some archbishop in Seattle and a couple of other bishops, and they represent 80% of the religious nuns in the United States, this leadership conference of women religious. And what they're accused of by the Vatican, and you can find it on the USCCB website, you can read the whole assessment, it's not that long, but what they essentially say is that the nuns have been too busy helping the poor and economically disadvantaged and fighting social injustice and dealing with the sick and not they have not spent enough time talking about abortion, birth control, gay marriage. Well, I've read the Gospels, and Jesus had quite a bit to say about the poor, economic injustice, the imprisoned, the sick, and he used to talk to sinners all the time. I don't recall Jesus saying anything about abortion, gay marriage, or birth control. And I'm not here taking a position on any of those issues. I'm just talking about priorities.
Well, you've covered a lot of ground rather quickly here. So we have the voice of the faithful, which is, as you mentioned, came into being just about 10 years ago. And my understanding is that the voice of the faithful is trying to give meaningful voice to lay people in the guidance and governance of the church. But isn't it the case that lay people have never had a voice? It's always been top down. You know, locally, I can say that we've seen...
Bert, I'm having trouble hearing you.
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me better now?
A little better.
Well, locally, we've seen a lot of priests transferred without any regard for the will of the congregation, popular priests, and by the voice of the faithful calling for democratization and more lay input into decision-making. Doesn't that radically change the nature of the church? Isn't hierarchy and obedience really an inherent part of the Catholic tradition?
Well, yeah, we're trying to change that to some extent. I wouldn't go so far as to say we're trying to democratize the church, but we want to have a voice. We want to be consulted. Now, they do consult lay people. Some bishops are better than others about consulting lay people. Big donors tend to be consulted more than just ordinary people in a lot of dioceses.
Yeah, I've heard that before.
But we would like to have that more regularized, more institutionalized, include more women in that process. And this started at the Vatican Council. It wasn't all our idea. This came out of the Vatican Council, which has commenced 50 years ago this year in Rome, and it encompassed all the bishops of the world at that time. It was convened by John the 23rd. And much of what we're doing and much of what we're saying comes right out of the documents of the Vatican Council, which specifically said that lay people have the right and sometimes the obligation to advise the sacred pastors of what's bothering them. That's not what the council... I'm using my own language there, but that's essentially what they said. And we're trying to implement some of that. Some of the people in the Roman Curia who were there at the time of the council said, as the council disbanded, in 50 years, we will have all this reversed. Well, it's been 50 years, and they've gotten some of it reversed.
Well, I'm trying to understand what's going on at the highest levels of the church now. We spoke a couple of weeks ago on this show about the attack, I suppose you could say, on the American women religious, the nuns, and... It's unclear as to what their strategy might be. What do you think the long-term strategy is? And trying to, you know, they've been trying to protect for many years child abusers, protecting and transferring child abusers. There's all kinds of resistance in Ireland and in various places throughout Western Europe. What are they trying to do? Do they have a long-term strategy? I mean, it seems to me that what they're doing is alienating a lot of the faithful, most dedicated people. They must have some sort of a strategy. What do you think, Ed?
Well, yeah, they must have some kind of a strategy. I think one of the problems of the Catholic Church, and not just in the last few years, has been an obsession with secrecy, which goes back a very, very long time. Martin Luther he wasn't a layperson. He was a priest. He tried to talk to them. Now, I'm not saying Martin Luther was a model of subtlety and how to make an approach and how to deal with authority.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, he tried to say something and was rebuked. Catherine of Siena was a nun in the 14th century, I believe. She actually did have a huge impact because she got the Pope to move out of Avignon and come back to Rome, where she felt the Pope ought to be. We have an annual award that we give out to a layperson who has shown courage and distinction and tried to make a difference, and we call it the Catherine of Siena Award. As to what the long-term strategy is, I wish we could figure it out. If you read the stories in the New York Times for the past 3 or 4 days have been about a Keystone Cops incident involving the Pope's butler having disclosed a lot of secret financial documents to somebody or other, or they're investigating it. And the Federico Lombardi, who was the Vatican spokesman, a Jesuit priest, actually made a statement last night: no cardinals are being investigated by the police. Well, isn't that wonderful to hear? No cardinals are being investigated. So, but I think their long-term obsession has been for probably centuries is, one, secrecy. Don't let anybody else know what you're doing. To some extent, you can understand some of that because they haven't always existed in a friendly environment from local governments, including Catholic governments such as the Holy Roman Empire. The Holy Roman Emperor and the Vatican were at each other's throats for many centuries. And they've had to, in this past century, they've had to live with Nazism, communism, and all sorts of hostility. Now it's happening in the Middle East. So there is a sensitivity to talking to authorities. I compare it to something that's going on right here in Brooklyn, where our district attorney is trying to investigate the Orthodox Jews for sexual abuse.
Hmm.
And these are the super Orthodox Jews.
Right.
And they will not talk to the authorities about anything without permission of the rabbi.
Hmm.
And our DA is trying to work out some sort of a deal where they could get this addressed and get away from that necessity to go through the very people who are part of the problem. See what's happening in the Catholic Church.
Interesting. They people who
pretty much resent anybody going to the authorities rather than talking to them. But when they talk to them, they covered it up. They're also obsessed with control. And we ran into that. My original involvement with Voice of the Faithful was with the affiliate here in Brooklyn, which I'm still involved with. And we had three objectives. Voice of the Faithful has three objectives. One is to support victims of sexual abuse, clerical sexual abuse. Secondly, is to support priests of integrity, because priests are secondary victims of this whole thing. And they're getting a terrible reputation and a very unfair presumption that priests are more likely than anybody else to commit sexual abuse. I don't think that's true at all. What is true is that their superiors have been covering it up over a period of a number of decades, and possibly longer than that. And so the third objective is to effect structural change to provide more of a voice for the laity and to provide institutional systems which will prevent this from happening. And that is what really sets the bishop's teeth on edge. You're going to try to change the church. A couple of people, including the late candidate Senator Santorum, came out and said, well, the Catholic Church is exactly as it has been for 2,000 years. Well, that is ignorant theology and even more ignorant history. Of course the Catholic Church changes. It has to change. It is a human institution. Now, we believe it's also a divine institution,
mm-hmm.
but it is populated by very fallible human beings, some of whom are bishops, some of whom are lay people such as ourselves. And if you're going to have any such institution, you better change or you're going to die. And I think a lot of our bishops really don't want to face that fact. And they don't want any change, and they're hostile to any kind of change. And I don't think this is a new phenomenon. I think it's been going on for a long time. And having been in an academic atmosphere, having been in corporate life, having been in the Navy, I see some of that. We call it clericalism. And I guess in secular institutions it's not clericalism, but it's the same thing. It's the elite, the people in charge, maintaining an elite status. And we've got that in the church. We have it in a lot of places in our society. But in the church, it's a real major problem. And the Roman Catholic Church now is the last monarchy in the Western world, the last absolute monarchy in the Western world.
Hmm.
Queen Elizabeth is still a monarch, but she doesn't have any real power. But the Pope has real power. And it's not exactly a hereditary monarchy, but it's inbred. The cardinals elect the Pope, and the Pope selects the cardinals, and then the cardinals select the next Pope, and so on, ad infinitum. And so, yeah, we're trying to get at some of these things. We've really only been tapping the surface, looking for things like parish councils, diocesan councils, financial accountability. That's another huge scandal in the church, is finances at the local level in dioceses and parishes in this country and, I guess, throughout the world. But now you're starting to see stories about even worse things happening in the Vatican. And we deal mostly in Voice of the Faithful with local issues in the United States and also Ireland and other places where we are. And the Vatican's finances has not been anything we've been paying much attention to, but the New York Times is.
Yeah.
There's a man named Jason Berry who has written a book called Render Unto Rome, which came out about a year ago, he's down in New Orleans, and he's very knowledgeable about these things.
And it does seem that there's this, as you said, cult of secrecy here. We've seen case after case after case of people in power in many different situations revering secrecy, and just what happens with that is it's kind of a karma, I think, that people who revere secrecy, truth will out, it does come out, and then, you know, you're in big trouble. And it seems like Voice of the Faithful and groups across the globe are trying to address that secrecy. Is secrecy, how much is secrecy part of the problem, and kind of a cult of secrecy? And you talked about the finances, this alleged thing now, it's called VatiLeaks. That's the nickname for it, with documents painting a picture of disarray within the financial dealings of the Vatican itself. And the Vatican seems more concerned about the fact that there was a leak than that there were problems that should be addressed. And I'm curious, Ed, you talk about some local financial issues. There's always collections, and the church is oftentimes doing very, very good things in the community for, you know, orphanages and a lot of good things. The nuns are helping people and reaching out and doing Jesus work, it seems to me. But what are some of the specific miscalculations or not quite appropriate dealings at the local level when it comes to these financial matters that the Voice of the Faithful is trying to get a hold of?
There have been, I suppose forever, but certainly over the 10 years of Voice of the Faithful's existence, a number of instances, either in parishes or in entire dioceses, of hundreds of thousands, even millions of dollars, being unaccounted for. And when somebody tries to ask a question about that, they often get stiff-armed by the hierarchy, which doesn't want to talk about it. There are a number of such examples. Let me mention one, which occurred a few years ago around 05 or 06 in the Diocese of Bridgeport, Connecticut, because that's fairly local to us and I'm a little bit familiar with it. And they had a priest who had stolen, it wasn't millions, I think it was just a few hundred thousand, but hundreds of thousands of dollars from his parish in, I believe it was Darien, Connecticut. The assistant pastor, a young priest by the name of, I forget his name, Moynihan or something like that, and the woman who was the parish accountant noticed this, started keeping track of it, and went to Bishop Laurie. Now, Bishop Laurie is an interesting guy. He was the bishop of Bridgeport, Connecticut, until about 2 weeks ago. Now he's the Archbishop of Baltimore. Anyway, Bishop Laurie didn't want to hear about it, and he disciplined the priest for talking. Well, the priest then wasn't born yesterday, and he went to the newspaper. And when it became public, now the bishop restored Moynihan to his position and announced how he's really investigating this and covering it up. It turned out that what had been happening is that the priest had been doing this to support vacations to Bermuda, a house in Manhattan, a whole raft of things that he was doing with his gay lover. Now, I'm not attacking gay people here. I'm just saying if you're going to do that kind of thing, you should do it on your own resources and not be taking the resources of the parish to have a lavish lifestyle, which is what was happening. Well, the bishop was furious that that came out, but ultimately he had to go along. Now, that same Bishop Laurie, it turns out, in a series of articles that were exposed by a man named Sandro Magister, who writes for L'Espresso in Rome, and it was picked up by America Magazine, which is the Jesuit magazine here in New York, and specifically by a Father Jim Martin, turned out that Bishop Laurie is the guy who originally instigated the whole problem with the nuns. And who did he go to about it? Bernard Law over in Rome. Bernard Law, the former Cardinal Archbishop of Boston, who was the original heavy in the whole sexual abuse scandal. Right. In fact, when the thing originally came out, the Vatican took the position, well, this was a problem in Boston. Well, it turns out it's a problem in the whole world. But Cardinal Law was permitted to resign the Vatican vigorously said at the time it had nothing to do with anything any lay people were asking for, or with the sexual abuse scandal. It had to do with he was unable to collect money. And he spent about a year as chaplain to some convent in Maryland or somewhere. And then he became the high priest of a major basilica, the Basilica of Mary the Greater, in Rome. And he held that position until about 3 or 4 months ago when he turned 80 and had to resign. Nevertheless, he apparently still has a lot of influence over what happens in the Church of the United States. And Laurie went to Cardinal Law. Law went to Cardinal Burke, who was another American former Archbishop of St. Louis, also very right-wing, and to Cardinal Levada, who was Cardinal Ratzinger, now Pope Benedict's successor at the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, and they initiated this inquisition on the nuns. They started with an investigation. Guess what? The investigation confirmed all the preconceptions they had. Isn't that amazing? And it took 3 or 4 years to do that. The original investigation had also been developed by the Vatican Congregation for Religious. The prefect of that congregation retired. A new guy came in who was a Brazilian, apparently didn't want any part of it. So it all went to Levada and the Congregation of the Doctrine of Faith, which is the successor to the old Congregation of the Inquisition. Hmm. And they came down like a ton of bricks last month on the nuns. And I understand the nuns are meeting, these leadership conference of women religious are meeting in Silver Spring to discern what they're going to do about all this. And so we'll be anxiously seeing what they, what, if anything, they announce about that in the next few days.
Yeah, that's going to be very, very interesting to see what happens there, and we'll certainly keep on top of that. You're listening to The Burt Cohen Show. Our guest is Ed Wilson, who's on the communications team of the Voice of the Faithful, trying to, I guess, revitalize the Catholic Church. How has something simple and straightforward, how has membership been in the United States? Has there been much of a change, say, in the past 10 years or so, or is it pretty much stable?
Membership in the Catholic Church?
Yeah.
Well, it's funny. It is stable and, in fact, increasing, but not because there aren't a whole lot of people leaving. What we've had in the last 25 or 30 years is a huge influx of immigrants, largely from Latin America, but also from Vietnam and other places in Asia.
Uh-huh.
And they are Catholics. They are much more like the immigrants that our ancestors were 100, 150 years ago. We are all the descendants of immigrants from Ireland, Italy, Germany, Poland, wherever.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish more of our people would understand that and pay more attention to the immigrants that are coming now. Now, the bishops have been very good at immigration, and that's a good thing, and it's a good Christian thing for them to do, and I applaud it. But I have a little bit of a reservation because those people are less educated than the people who are now assimilated Americans, such as myself and most of the people in Voice of the Faithful. And so I think some of the bishops may feel they can control those people a little better than they can control us.
Ah.
And so the overall number of Catholics in the United States may be stable or even increasing. But it's also true that if you were to put them all together, the second largest denomination, religious denomination, in the United States would be former Catholics. I think it was the Pew Research came out some months ago and said that a third of native-born Catholics who were born since, I don't know, 1940 or 50 or something, have left the church and are now either Episcopalians, Presbyterians, or no religion at all,
right,
or still call themselves Catholic but don't go to church or pay much attention. And so the Vatican, ironically, is convening a conference in Rome in June called the New Evangelization. That's a big project of the Pope, and all the bishops in this country are using that language too. The New Evangelization doesn't mean they're going to go out and try to convert Jews or Presbyterians or anybody else. It means they're going to try to bring back the Catholics who have left, who just don't understand. I've heard a couple of bishops say that the Catholics just don't understand the birth control position. If we could only communicate it better, then everybody would understand, and they would go along. Well, Paul VI came out with that in 1968. I think the bishops are intelligent people, and some of them are quite good communicators.
Mm-hmm.
It's been 44 years, and people still just don't understand. Is that because we're all dumb?
Well, it's interesting how, once again, it seems to come back to people in a position of power don't want to look in the mirror. Just don't look in the mirror.
Absolutely. And they're obsessed with their power. And I think this attack on the nuns is a panic.
Yeah.
And things are really coming apart, it seems to me, in the Vatican and among the bishops. There was a story last week out of California that a number of bishops are quite upset at these lawsuits being brought because of the bishop's assertion that the mandate to provide contraceptive, provide insurance for contraceptive drugs somehow violates somebody's religious freedom, which, as a lawyer, I don't really see that, nor have I seen any reputable or authoritative legal authority confirm that this was an issue of religious freedom. I've heard a bunch of bishops say it. There's a story this morning's Wall Street Journal by somebody named William McGurn to that effect. But I haven't heard of any professors, even from Fordham or Georgetown or Catholic law schools, confirming any such thing. And so a group of right-wing bishops are giving the impression that they're becoming part of the Republican campaign this year,
mm-hmm.
and they're bringing these lawsuits. And some, there was a bishop, I think his name was Blair in Stockton, California, who was saying just that and complaining about it. You obviously have different factions doing different, going in different directions over in the Vatican. We really don't know much about that. It's whatever we can find out from that butler. But I'm sure a lot more is going to come out because the Italian press is all over this.
Oh, yeah.
The New York Times seems to be becoming interested, as does Reuters.
Well, it sells papers, and papers are having their own difficulty these days. And that's, you know, one thing about the so-called Obamacare.
I can't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's one thing about Obamacare these days, that it has been a flashpoint for many. We've heard an awful lot about from Obamacare and the Catholic Church on the on right-wing radio and TV, false news, Fox News, of course I meant.
I'm having great trouble hearing you.
Can you hear me now?
A little better.
Oh, my. I'm not quite sure why, but we'll be working on that here. I want to talk about Obamacare. It's been a flashpoint for many in the church. As you mentioned, there are lawsuits brought by 43 Catholic organizations, including 13 dioceses, to overturn the regulations. Is this, and the argument seems to be whether or not the administration is requiring insurance plans to cover contraception under the new health care law. Is this a position of the majority of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops? It sounds like there are some bishops who disagree with the opposition to health care reform. And as you mentioned, Jesus was certainly caring very much about the sick. And I guess birth control isn't necessarily about being sick, but it does have to do with poverty and health care in general. So how much of a split is there with regard to Obamacare in the church?
Well, in the church generally, including people like ourselves,
right?
Quite a bit of a split, because I think something like 82%, there was a Gallup poll a week or so ago saying that 82% of Catholics don't agree with the teaching on birth control.
Wow.
And Voice of the Faithful doesn't have a position on that.
Uh-huh.
I'd point that out. But nevertheless, we do read the New York Times and read what the polls are saying.
Right.
There was another poll 6 or 7 months ago which said that 98% of Catholic women who had been sexually active had used birth control at one time or another.
Mm-hmm.
So the bishops don't have a lot of consent on that issue. Now, on the religious freedom issue, as I say, there is this bishop in California who points out that only 13 dioceses have brought these suits. I'm sure there are some other, shall I say, conservative or right-wing bishops, such as the Archbishop of Philadelphia, Chaput, and Bishop Laurie, Archbishop Laurie of Baltimore, who very much support this kind of thing, although for one reason or another, their diocese didn't bring the lawsuit. But this bishop in California said that, and I think they had an agreement among the California bishops, which said they weren't going along with this, and they wanted to discuss it more, and it should have been discussed among all the bishops at the conference they're going to have in Atlanta in June. So there may be some fireworks there. One thing I'll guarantee you is that the press will not be admitted into those discussions, because even when they disagree, they're secretive about it, and that's been the problem. The more right-wing bishops, the more progressive bishops, have no problem speaking to the press. Cardinal Dolan is very good at dealing with the press, and he comes across as a very affable and friendly person. And bishops who disagree may say something quietly in private, but they're not going to come out and go public. So this little thing we heard from California last week may be a presager of something or other. Huh. Don't know what yet, but we'll be seeing.
Very interesting.
And all this business in Rome is another indication of disarray. Some of the charges that have been made are that a bunch of cardinals in Rome who were involved with finance were granting contracts to their brothers-in-law or their sons-in-law or various people that to whom favors are ordered or are owed. And so we'll see what comes out of that. I could suspect that the American cardinals aren't getting any of that, and so they're leaning on the nuns and doing things they can do.
Wow. Well,
but that's only a guess. That's Ed Wilson speculating. I have no inside knowledge about that.
Well, you have a lot better position from which to guess than most people do, I think. And I wonder how, again, we mentioned the name Rick Santorum, former candidate for president, and his campaign, frankly, did pretty well. They framed the issue as about contraception as a war on religion, threats to religious freedom. How do you think most, you know, just lay people in the American Catholic Church feel about that? Do you have any sense, Ed, that that's resonating, that people agree, yes, there is a war on religion, yes, the Obama administration is threatening religious freedom?
Well, we're going to find out. I unfortunately have the people I know and the people I talk to don't give much credence to that. I know a couple of people who do. And one priest who's very bright but had a good friend disagrees with me about this. And he's a very smart, educated guy. But how the general population of the Catholic laity, I don't know. That would include the Latinos, the Vietnamese, and the Knights of Columbus. And I'm really not in touch with people like that, so I don't know.
Yeah, the Knights of...
Historically, Catholics have not voted as a bloc. They were an immigrant group, and so they tended to vote Democratic most of the time, not because of religious issues, but because of social issues. Now, I don't mean social issues like abortion. I mean welfare and labor laws and that kind of thing.
Sure.
And as Catholics have joined the more economically well-off, you start to have a lot of Catholic Republicans. And so some of them are quite conservative nowadays, which wasn't true historically. Although I guess the whole communist issues put a lot of Catholics on the right back in the 50s and 60s.
No, that...
Where it is going, I don't know. But it's interesting to talk about Santorum, that he didn't resonate so well. He didn't test himself in Pennsylvania. He withdrew before the Pennsylvania primary.
Right.
But he did best in places like Alabama and Mississippi, where the majority of people are not Catholic at all. They're right-wing evangelical Protestants.
Right.
And that's another whole story. There's a man named Richard Newhouse, Richard John Newhouse, who was a Lutheran minister. And in the 60s, as a Lutheran minister, he was part of clergy concerned about Vietnam. And he was a liberal guy.
Mm-hmm.
Something happened in the late 60s or 70s. He becomes obsessed about abortion, becomes a Roman Catholic priest, and in the 80s and 90s, he gets together with Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and the evangelical right, Protestant right, forms an alliance with them, and this alliance emerges within the Republican Party. And so there is a considerable conservative Catholic presence in the Republican Party. John Boehner, who's the Speaker of the House, is a pretty conservative Catholic. There's this guy, Paul Ryan. I'm not sure whether Mitch McConnell is Catholic or not. But there is this alliance, and it was formed within the Republican Party, and it was formed by Newhouse and the evangelicals, and I regard it as very unhealthy. And to the extent the bishops are cooperating with that faction, I find that very, very disturbing.
Interesting. Yeah, that's a very good point. And, you know, traditionally, you're right, candidates for public office have expected new immigrant Catholics to vote pretty uniformly, and it's generally been on, you know, issues that face any immigrant group in America. And, you know, as people of our generation whose parents or grandparents came here, it's a bit of a different thing. And this year, we see the rise of awareness across the spectrum on economic issues, by what's perceived by many people to be a question of the morality of power existing, you know, unfairly at the top 1%. And there's a call for government to, you know, stop being beholden exclusively to the 1% and start to work for the 100%. And I know that there has been a tradition in the Catholic Church back when Ramparts magazine was started, which was certainly to the left of center in the mid-60s, which did oppose.
I knew the people that ran that.
I'm sorry, what?
I knew the people that ran that.
Oh, it was a great magazine. I wish I still had copies of it.
They were fun.
Well, they were on the left, no question about it. But I wonder if there's any, this 99 to 1%, is there any overlap with Voice of the Faithful's call for fairness, dialogue, and discussion? And how do you think this 99, 1% thing will resonate with Catholic voters? Any clue on that, Ed?
Well, it ought to resonate with Christian voters, and I think I can expand that to Judeo-Christian. I think Jews are pretty well on board with us on these issues, that we believe in social justice. We believe in not a strict redistribution of wealth. I don't want socialism.
Right.
But we believe in more fairness in our society and in our tax code. And I don't see how any Christian can be supporting no tax increase whatsoever for the 1%. That just strikes me as counterintuitive and a bit nuts. And how that is playing among the Catholic population, historically, we Catholics have voted more on economic issues than on other issues.
Uh-huh.
Now, Voice of the Faithful stays out of politics.
Right.
But we, you know, that doesn't mean we're deaf, dumb, and blind. We see what's going on.
Right.
But we don't endorse candidates or do anything like that. But certainly have some candidates I wouldn't dream of voting for. This whole attack on Obama strikes me as a political attack. And again, as a lawyer, I don't see that freedom of religion has anything to do with requiring an exemption for people who have a personal moral position, which is contrary to, which would not permit contraception. Jehovah's Witnesses have a moral position against blood transfusions.
Hmm.
That doesn't mean they get an exemption if they have an organization that hires non-Jehovah's Witnesses. That doesn't mean they don't have to provide medical care, which will include blood transfusions. And there is a Supreme Court case to that effect. It was written by Justice Scalia in about 1990 and involved the Paiute Indians. And what that case said was that as long as a law is not aimed at a particular religious group, if it's a law which is of general application for public health or for, in the Peyote case, it had to do with illegal drugs being an unhealthy phenomenon in this country, and you didn't get an exemption because you belong to some religion which
mandated
the use of drugs or, by analogy, prohibited the use of contraception. The other thing that came out of the Vatican Council, while we're on that subject, and also there's a man named John Henry Newman, who was probably the greatest English-speaking theologian ever, but certainly in the last couple of hundred years. He was a 19th-century Anglican don, an Oxford don, converted to Catholicism around age 40, and wrote a series of papers, or white papers, whatever you want to call them, one of which was on consulting the faithful in matters of doctrine. And what that said was that a doctrine is not a doctrine of the church just because a bunch of bishops come out and say it. It has to be received by the people. Now, exactly what people does that mean? I don't think you take a Gallup poll.
Yeah.
But if most theologians, most scholars, most knowledgeable people don't accept a doctrine, then it's difficult for the bishops to claim that it is a doctrine. And I would put, and again, this is not a Voice of the Faithful position. This is Ed Wilson talking.
Okay.
but I would put the birth control prohibition in that category, something that has not been received by the people, which has not been explained in any way that they could understand. For 80 years, really, since Pius XI came out with the original prohibition.
And certainly Obamacare doesn't necessarily cross that line if people in these institutions are personally opposed to abortion and to contraception. It doesn't necessarily affect them. Am I here? Is that correct on that? Like if they have personal opposition to it, the Obamacare isn't going to cross that line.
No, nor have I seen a recognized legal scholar say that it does.
Right.
I've heard some bishops say that it does. I heard this guy McGurn in the Wall Street Journal this morning say that it does, but I haven't heard even a constitutional legal scholar from Fordham, Georgetown, Santa Clara, or for that matter, Notre Dame.
Interesting.
If you look at the 43 institutions, the chief people who would be concerned with this would be Catholic colleges and universities. Now, if you see, they had four colleges or universities among these plaintiffs. One was the Catholic University in Washington. That is a pontifical university. It is under the Pope. It's a fine university, and it does have very good academic credentials. It has a number of faculty members who are not Catholic, and a number of people who go there who are not Catholic, and so they are subject to the mandate. They're suing. I can understand why the Pope has told them you better sue. Two small colleges in the Midwest, one in Steubenville, Ohio, another someplace in Indiana. I know nothing about them. And then there's Notre Dame. And Notre Dame invited Obama to speak 3 years ago, took a lot of heat from the bishops in doing so, and now they are the only major Catholic university involved in this lawsuit, along with Catholic University. They're one of two, and then Notre Dame is a major national, recognized national university of whatever denomination.
Sure.
And they're in this lawsuit, and I suspect they're being pressured to do this. It speaks volumes to me that not one Jesuit school is involved in this. As a Jesuit alumnus, I'm happy to say that, but not Fordham, not Georgetown, not Marquette, not Santa Clara, not Holy Cross, not Boston College, none of them are involved in this. And you better believe that they were asked.
Yeah. Well, we're moved beyond the United States. Ireland has had, you know, their fair share of difficulties with the church and, you know, abusive priests and the same kind of thing. And I read that there was a discussion recently, a paper written by Sean O'Connell about a recent conference in Dublin called Towards an Assembly of the Irish Catholic Church. He referred to, as we discussed, I thought this was particularly good language here, the Arctic coldness and aridity of Roman authoritarianism. But he also said, interestingly, that there was great inspiration and hope at that conference. Something about participation. Sean O'Connell talked about two embodiments of the church. What does he mean by that? And what's this hope that seems to be bubbling up?
I know Sean. He's a friend. We're in touch with Ireland all the time. I didn't read that particular statement, so I don't know what he meant. But I do know about that conference. And what's interesting about it is there is an Association of Irish Catholic Priests, which encompasses about 25% of the priests in Ireland, and they called that conference at a hotel in Dublin for May 7th. They're expecting about 200 people. They got 1,000.
Wow.
Now, they have a much worse sexual abuse problem than we had here in the United States. Their situation was truly horrible, and the bishops in Ireland were totally supine about it, with the honorable and notable exception of Archbishop Dermot Martin of Dublin. He has been fantastic. And he has not been made a cardinal, although he clearly would be somebody who would expect to be made a cardinal. So he's paid for it, but he showed great courage and great eloquence. Sean is a former professor. He writes brilliantly, and we love him. What I noticed about that conference is that they've had this tremendous sexual abuse problem, but they also got into all sorts of other issues of contention with the church. And the people of Ireland, that was the most Catholic country in the world.
Sure.
They were the most loyal Catholics in the world. and they're down to something like 10 or 15% of the population goes to church on Sunday. So this is what the bishops have done to themselves in Ireland. It's starting to happen here, but Ireland, it has happened in spades. And speaking of conferences,
yes,
the Faithful is having a conference September 14th and 15th in Boston. It's at the Marriott Copley Plaza Hotel, and we're going to have speakers on all of these topics. We're going to have Justice Ann Burke, who was a justice of the Illinois Supreme Court. She was one of the first chairs of the National Review Board set up by the bishops to monitor what was happening with sexual abuse. She immediately got into all sorts of conflict with the bishops, who didn't want her to open her mouth or have anything to say. She went over to Rome while she had that job and tried to see a bunch of cardinals. The only cardinal who would sit down and talk to her was Cardinal Ratzinger, now Pope Benedict.
Mm-hmm.
So this is 9 or 10 years ago. At that time, Ratzinger did listen, did talk to her, was cordial. I don't know what to conclude from that, but we can just report that. We also have John Morgan, who is the chairman of the Irish Lay Catholic Association, of not quite sure what sort, and he's going to be talking about all these things at the conference. We're going to have Jamie Manson, who is about 30 years old. She's a young woman who is a strong feminist. She's going to be talking about all sorts of women's issues, and she is well worth hearing. I've heard her talk a couple of times. She's fabulous. She writes regularly for the National Catholic Reporter. And we're also going to have Monsignor Connell. He's the vice chancellor of the Diocese of Milwaukee, and he has been an absolute, very outspoken guy on the misconduct of the bishops on sexual abuse, and yet he still has that position in Milwaukee. He's going to be talking, and he's going to be saying the Mass on Saturday evening. And then we have Thomas Groom, who is a professor of religious education and Catholic studies at Boston College. I think he's an ex-priest. He's a man in his 40s, and he's very well worth listening to. So it's going to be an exciting and wonderful conference, and I would urge people to get in touch with voiceofthefaithful.org for details on how and when and where and all that.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I certainly didn't want to forget that. So, with all these difficulties and challenges that the Catholic Church is facing in the Western world, Ed Wilson, you're very, very active in Voice of the Faithful. Is there, as Sean O'Connell talked about, two embodiments in the Church? What reasons might there be for optimism, for actual reform? I mean, it seems like the Church hasn't changed much for hundreds of years. Do you have a sense of optimism that this, as you mentioned, in Ireland, it's 200 were expected, 1,000 showed up, and now you got the Voice of the Faithful 10-year conference coming up in Boston. Do you sense some kind of a rejuvenation?
Yeah, well, you say the Church hasn't changed much in hundreds of years. I think it has. And it depends what you mean by the Church. If you mean the Pope and the hierarchy and the little group who wield authority,
yes,
they've changed too, but we are the Church. We are all the Church. And the Church is all baptized Christians. And we have changed enormously. And James Joyce, 100 years ago, in Finnegan's Wake, described the Catholic Church as, here comes everybody. By which he meant everybody was included. You had all sorts of ethnicities, all sorts of educational levels, all sorts of economic levels. He wasn't just talking about Ireland. He was talking about the universality of the Church. The word Catholic means universal. And the Roman pontiff is called just that, the pontiff. That's a bridge. He's supposed to be a bridge among various factions, if you will, within the Church. And I think that the everybody who James Joyce was talking about have changed enormously in their attitude and their outlook. We have in the United States and in Western Europe and in Australia an educated, articulate group of people who are involved with the Church, who aren't just going to say, yes, Father, anytime they hear anything from Rome or from their local bishop. And the Church, the hierarchy, I keep saying Church, what I mean the hierarchy. The hierarchy is not the Church. We are all the Church. that the hierarchy are frightened by this. They are frightened out of their wits. This is being manifested, I think, by the attack on the nuns, by the silencing of priests in Ireland, the silencing of priests in Austria, and a few grumblings from various places in the world. For example, there was a parish in Vienna about 6 months ago, which elected to its parish council a gay person who was in one of those committed registered partnerships with his gay partner.
Right.
He was 27 years old. He was elected by his fellow parishioners to be a member of the parish council. The pastor nixed it, vetoed it, said he can't be on there. Somehow, Cardinal Schönborn of Vienna, who is a major European prelate, who was a student of Cardinal Ratzinger, now the Benedict Pope, in Regensburg many years ago, is a friend of the Pope, as a man of huge influence. He reversed the pastor, had lunch with this gay man and his partner, said they are perfectly fine Catholics, there's no reason they can't serve on the parish council. So, little things are happening, and little things have a habit of turning into big things.
True.
There was also another parish in Austria where they were having a first communion. This is about a month ago. And the priest comes out and announces that only the children receive communion, and then among the adults, only baptized Catholics who are in the state of grace, not guilty of any sin, can receive communion. Well, the children went up and received communion, and not one adult went to the communion rail. They were just making a statement.
Wow.
And this got reported all over the world. You have the bishop in California raising questions about this lawsuit. You have not just Voice of the Faithful, but there's a whole bunch of Catholic reform organizations, all of whom had people out in front of St. Patrick's Cathedral. They'll be there again tonight. They were there on Tuesday the 15th, Tuesday the 22nd, in support of the nuns. The same thing happened in Philadelphia, and it's happened in Cincinnati, and I'm not totally sure where else it has or hasn't happened, but this is a major, firestorm about what the Vatican is doing to the nuns. People like the nuns, and people recognize that the nuns are doing the work of Jesus Christ more than most bishops. The other thing that's happening with the bishops, and it may always have been true, but there's one particular bishop that I know, and I like him, and he's a good guy, and he's smart. He was amazed that Obama won the election last time, and that Obama got the majority of the Catholic vote. He absolutely couldn't understand that. He just talks to other bishops, and he has no idea what the people are saying.
Uh-huh.
The nuns are out in the streets. They're out in the parishes. They're out talking to people. They know what's happening in the world. The bishops want... There's an old saying, once you become a bishop, you become a bishop, you'll never have a bad meal, and you'll never again hear the truth. And that is resonating with me. I've been listening to what the bishops are saying, and I think that's the truth. People aren't going to go tell Cardinal Dolan what's really going on. So he thinks he's right all the time. This happens with chief executive officers.
Sure.
It happens with admirals and generals. It happens in a lot of places in society. There's a wonderful book on clericalism written by a man named George Wilson, a Jesuit, no relation to me, in Cincinnati. I think he's at Xavier, Ohio. It's about clericalism in the world generally, and with an emphasis on the church, but he points out how it happens in society generally. And I think clericalism, secrecy, and the insularity that the bishops have is going to be their downfall.
Mm.
I don't think that can survive in an educated democratic society. And we haven't had that kind of a Catholic society anywhere. But now you have it here, Europe, Australia, and increasingly in places in the third world.
Ed Wilson, what do you...
I do think there's some room for optimism.
Yeah.
And I think there's lots of room for any Catholics who are listening who would like to join Voice of the Faithful to contact our main office in Boston, VOTF.org, and their phone number is 781-559-3360.
And people can sign up for the, who can attend the Voice of the Faithful 10-year conference? Why don't you give that information out again?
That is going to be a great conference, and we're hoping to rejuvenate. We're going to have some celebration of the fact that we're still around after 10 years. A lot of people predicted we wouldn't last 6 months.
Hmm.
And we have 40,000 members throughout the country and Ireland and Canada and a couple of people in Australia and other places. I think we're going to be trying in the next 10 years to be forming relationships with groups in other countries, because there are groups in Austria, in Germany, in Italy, for that matter. We do have a large group in Ireland.
I'm sure.
Ann and I had two of them here to dinner a couple of years ago.
Nice.
In the summer, and they're wonderful people. And they have a very fine archbishop in Dublin. He is a genuine hero.
Yeah.
We tried to get him to come to the conference, but the problem is one archbishop can't come in the face of the Cardinal Archbishop of Boston, who would not have been happy with his doing that.
Yeah, fascinating.
So we can understand that he wasn't able to come. But we did get this John Morgan, who is the head of a large Catholic lay organization.
Well, Ed Wilson, thank you so much for being with us today. And if people want to find out more about this upcoming 10th year conference, just go to votf.org, and the information is there.
All right. Of the faithful, votf.org.
All right.
Just Google it.
All right. Well,
you'll find us.
Thank you.
And we have a blog.
Ah, good. Thank you so much. And I have a feeling it's going to continue to grow. Thank you so much for being with us on the Bert Cohen Show.
Oh, we're at the beginning of a 200-year story.
Ah, good for you for having that patience. My goodness, that's great. Not everybody does. Thank you.
Dear God, hope you got the letter, and I pray you can make it better down here. I don't mean a big reduction in the price of beer, but all the people that you made in your image, see them starving on their feet, 'cause they don't get enough.